Thank you for having me here. It's great to be back. I deeply apologize for last year. What happened last year was that on Thursday around noon, my voice completely disappeared without any warning. My voice had been fine around 10:30 in the morning, and I noticed a shifting occurring, and I thought, what's that? And by noon, I was whispering like this. And I had to call so regretfully and say, you know, I just can't come. And I really felt badly about that, so I apologize. And for my information, how many people will be here tomorrow? They will come to Nalanda tomorrow? How many people? Okay, thank you. So for those of you who are coming tomorrow, this talk this evening, the three wholesome exchanges of the heart would be a segment of, if we were doing this as a whole thing, this would be one of those segments, but this works separately for the people who won't be coming tomorrow, so it works both ways. And indeed, what we're talking about this evening, what we're exploring together, is what I term the three wholesome exchanges of the heart. Most of you would be familiar with the Buddha's story of his own calling and forth, and his great experience that led him to his realization, and then the wonderful teachings that he gave to the world over a period of many decades. And in the story of the myth of his experience, it is said that it started with the three heavenly messengers of old age, sickness, and death, and of his being confounded with what is the meaning of life, given that we get old and sick and die. What is the meaning of a temporary moment of pleasantness, or many temporary moments of pleasantness? How does one contextualize? How does one find meaning? How does one find a release from the tension, the dukkha, the suffering that comes given these three heavenly messengers? And then there was a fourth messenger, and that was seeing one who was a renunciate, one who had gone forth from the regular way of relating to the ever-changing world, to a different kind of relationship, the cultivation of a different relationship to the world. Not changing the world as we find it in this realm, but changing how we relate to it. And he was inspired by the calmness and the collectedness of this one who had gone forth to see what that was for himself. And then having gone forth, having left everything behind, which to me it must always be said to include his young child, his young son, and his loving wife, having been so motivated to think that this was the right thing to do, he set about a long journey for himself that involved much arduous work. Ajahn Chah, my teacher, Ajahn Sumedho's teacher, the Venerable Ajahn Chah, I quote in the front of Dancing with Life, is saying that there are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering, which we're quite familiar with that, everyone in the room, and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And Ajahn Chah concludes by saying, if you're not willing to experience the second kind, you will surely continue to experience the first. That's the essential proposition. And the Buddha had some intuitive realization of this in choosing to go forward, that came from this experience of others that led him to this. And we have that same choice. The Buddha said in his teachings, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Some people say, no, that's two things, suffering, the end of suffering. But he's saying, no, it's one thing, that it's just this turn. It's one thing. There's suffering if related to one way, and if related to the very same experience, not changing experience, but changing how we're relating to it, it's another thing. It's the end of suffering. It's not this continuity of suffering. It's this slight change in that way. And I have more and more called, tended to call that the choice, that this is the one choice we have, to choose non-suffering over suffering, and that all of our practice is empowering us to choose non-suffering over suffering. Of course we're going to change conditions when we can. Of course we're going to do that. We don't want our children to hurt. We don't want people killing other people. We don't want the innocent being victimized. Of course we're going to change what we can in the way of conditions. When we can choose health over non-health, change conditions so that health will arise, we will do that. But so much of life in this realm, we can't change the conditions. We can't change the conditions of ourselves, the conditions of others, the conditions of the world. And so the relief from suffering is not through changing conditions, but through changing how we're relating to conditions, including, again, what's ourselves. So, in this regard, the Buddha went out into the world to figure out how to choose non-suffering over suffering. And in doing so, he went to study first with a teacher named Alara Kalama, where he learned all that teacher had to offer him. That teacher he held in great reverence. That teacher paid attention to him, witnessed his own struggles and growth, gave him advice, and the Buddha learned. The Buddha thrived and learned all that teacher had to offer. And the teacher offered then to say, you have now mastered what I know. Why don't you join me in teaching what we both now know? And the Buddha said, thank you so much for all that you have shared and for witnessing me. But I must go on because what I seek is not yet found in these teachings. And so then he goes on to his second teacher, Udaka. I mispronounce all these words, I'm sure. Udaka Ramaputta. And here he found yet more teachings of concentration, of actual, the thing of pieces of dependent origination, many of the things that we associate with the Buddha, because many of the teachings, of the larger teachings, were part of the teachings at the time. The Buddha had certain teachings that he created that he discovered, as he might put it, that were unique to him, but not all of it. And here again, he was seen, he was witnessed, he was taught, he was encouraged, he learned, he thrived, and once again, he learned what this teacher, the second of the most esteemed teachers of his time and place, had to offer. And again, he was offered to be equal teacher with this teacher. And again, he declined with respect and gratitude and said, I have not yet found the nature of freedom that I seek. And so he went forth thinking that maybe by beating down the body, by taking this route of extreme asceticism, that he could find this freedom, this relation to the unfolding time-space experience in a way that would free him from the clinging, the grasping, the getting caught in the suffering of conditions. And after many years of this, he came to the conclusion, just as he was near death from this kind of ascetic practice, we're told, he came to the conclusion that no, extreme asceticism also is not the teaching. This too does not bring deliverance from suffering. It does not bring the end of suffering. It does not give one the choice of non-suffering over suffering. And so he started to nourish himself once again, and he sat down, and with his own guidance from his own experience and his deep faith and his deep commitment, had the realization under the Bodhi tree that we've all heard so many times. And then after that awakening, this realization, this deep realization of the connection of all things and how things arise and pass and what is the deathless, he in fact stayed in a state of bliss for an extended period of time. And in the midst of that bliss, there arose in him, call it a whatever, an impulse, an intuition, some sort of feeling to share what he had learned. And as he did this, he reported in his own teaching, at first when he had that thought to do that, he thought, no, this is too subtle. Nobody's going to understand it. And that would be very vexing, he said, to not have anyone understand. But then he thought about his two teachers, whom he had such respect and care for. And he said, oh, they would understand. They would get this because they have little dust in their eyes. And then through his third eye, this intuitive wisdom, which we have various feelings of ourselves at time, of this kind of intuitive wisdom, this kind of knowing that is extraordinary knowing, he realized that by now both of these teachers had died. And then he thought of these five friends that he had studied with, that he had practiced with, been with them as he practiced, who had been so disdainful of him when he abandoned the ascetic practices, they continued the practice of asceticism. And he thought, they might understand this. And this led him to realize that there were people alive in his time that had so little dust in their eye that they might be able to understand this teaching. And so he set out on his journey to offer what he had come to understand, what wisdom he had, what realization he had. Now, as I say, almost everyone here would be familiar with this story in greater or smaller detail. So why am I telling it? Why would this relate to the three wholesome exchanges of the heart? It relates because he demonstrates in his story each of these wholesome exchanges. The Buddha expressed this need of the heart. We saw in the Buddha story this need of the heart for a wholesome exchange of being called forth. It was the heavenly messengers, all four, the three and the one, that then called him forth to this exploration. And each of us need to be called forth, not just once in our life, but repeatedly in our lives in various ways. This need to be called forth. We need to be called forth developmentally, just as children. We need to be called forth to manifest in the world, to make our way in the world, to be a contributor in the world, to a contributor to others. And we need to be called forth in relation to the spiritual journey, to our own inner awakening, our own inner development. This is an innate need of the heart. It needs this awakening. It needs this awakening. Ideally, it is called forth by others. If not, then it may be conditions that call it forth in this way. It may be a kind of inner knowing that calls it forth. It may be a difficulty, a real extreme difficulty that calls it forth at each of these levels, as a developmental level, as a manifestation level, and as an inner journey. So this is the first of the three wholesome exchanges of the heart, that of being called forth. It's a wonderful experience at any age to be called forth. And as we will see in the spiritual journey, it, no matter how much circumstances or your own innate wisdom, some intuitive knowing in you has called you forth, there still comes a time when we need to be called forth by others. And then the second of the wholesome exchanges that of the heart that's reflected in the Buddha's story is the need to be witnessed. The Buddha didn't suddenly realize, I want to go forth and wake up. He had the great, he was a recipient of the great generosity of these two teachers from which he learned, from which he began his journey. He was in fact witnessed and met by these two teachers. And part of his development process was that being witnessed. And each of us, not being the Buddha, although maybe of Buddha nature, but not being developed on our own, we too need to have our heart experiencing this being witnessed. It is the heart that finally becomes liberated. Those of you who have read Rodney's new book, he does a very good job of describing all of this, in my view. Just a really fine job. And so, how does this heart get liberated? It's called forth. It's witnessed. And then finally, there arises from that witnessing a kind of awakening, a kind of understanding of varying degrees, maybe just psychological maturity, or maybe just the ability to keep the precepts, or maybe just this one thing about right speech, or just understanding generosity, but a profound understanding of generosity, or just a willing to serve. That's what's awakened in us. We're not in charge of what gets awakened. We're in charge of making the choice to practice, the choice to choose non-suffering through the choosing of practice. We don't get to choose the results. The results are due to such larger causes and conditions. But to whatever degree the heart has been liberated, there arises a need within the heart to share, to in turn give back from what has been received. And so this is the third of the wholesome exchanges, this giving witness of what we've learned. And in turn, in that kind of sharing, offering what we have learned, one of the things that we do is we give witness to others at that time. So these are the three wholesome exchanges of the heart. Certainly we understand the Buddha in terms of having been called forth by what he experienced, what he saw, and then the Buddha being witnessed by his teachers, and also one could say by his fellow practitioners during those years that he wandered as an ascetic. One could argue that both ways, I guess. And then finally, his realization that he had a calling of his heart to share his great generosity from which we are all the beneficiaries. And so this exploration this evening is to look a little deeper into each of these exchanges of the heart, to see their wholesome nature, and also to acknowledge how they can get out of balance and not be wholesome. Because each in our ego-possessed states, in our clinging, in our grasping, in our wanting to possess, we can fall into a kind of shadow exchange of, which is not so wholesome, exchange of the heart. So in naming that, we're not naming it as some terrible thing, but as a cautionary tale to keep us each in balance when we participate either side of these three exchanges, because each of us throughout our lives, and in particular times of our lives more one than the other, we are either being called forth or we're playing the role of calling someone forth by either directly acting in some way to call forth, or our very presence or our very actions calling someone forth. And likewise, we're either being witnessed or we are witnessing for someone else. And we are either the recipient of sharing, of someone receiving someone's offering, or we're making an offering. So we're always involved in both sides of these three after a certain age, in a conscious choice way. So starting with this one of the feeling of. Well, one more thing to say before that. I teach along with Adrian Ross and sometimes Guy Armstrong a retreat on exploring the nature of awareness. And on that retreat, and on any long retreat when you have more time, there's always this possibility that you start to explore awareness and emptiness. You start to have certain realizations about awareness and emptiness, and you discover that these three wholesome exchanges of the heart are just entwined, ensconced in awareness itself, in what some people call Buddha nature, that they're inherent, they're innate in each of us. It's sort of like shocking in some way, given how we can be so aware of our limitations. And yet to say, oh, even in my poor heart, even in all of my misguided mind, here there lies this innate, pure capacity that is already there. And you see the way, this very subtle binding of the co-arising of all of our experience and our oneness in this. But that's at a subtle level that we're not going to be exploring this evening. But I did want to make sure that was offered as it's so for future reference. I don't know what to call these three wholesome exchanges exactly. Are they impulses of the heart? Are they instincts of the heart? Are there needs of the heart? Are there intuitions of the heart? I don't know. Whatever word feels right to you, what resonates in your own experience of your heart, because you've all felt these. Everyone in this room. You may not have thought about it too much, or you may have thought about it a lot. You may have looked time and again for a witness. You may have tried to put yourself in positions where you would be called forth. And others not thought about so much, but no one would be without some feel for these exchanges. Albert Einstein says, only if outward and inward... can't read my writing without my glasses. Only if outward and inward freedom are constantly and consciously pursued is there a possibility of spiritual development and improving outer and inner life. Only if outward and inward freedom are pursued. These wholesome exchanges are part of that pursuit of outward and inward freedom, in my view. As I said, in terms of the first of these wholesome exchanges of the heart, that of being called forth, some more than others were the beneficiaries of being called forth in various ways as a child. And those of you who had that experience in some way, you certainly can now reflect on the benefits of that being called forth. And maybe it was in your home life, but maybe not. Maybe it was a neighbor across the street, or maybe it was an older brother or sister, or maybe it was a school teacher, or something about someone you read, and it wasn't the actual person, but this story you read, something about that person that became so real, it called you forth in some way, into your own life, into your own inner sense of worth, and inner sense of development. And certainly many people, just because our societies, all societies, are structured to call every child forth into a development process. Starting actually with that first paying attention and stimulating the child, that's a calling forth. And when that doesn't occur, we call that failure to thrive, and a baby dies. So this calling forth is tied in to the very moving into the existence in this realm. And then as you grow older still, as a teenager and going through adolescence and all, still in many different ways called forth, and how important that is that we hear this, that we get that calling forth, and that in some way we respond. It doesn't have to be such a successful response, but just that we started that process of responding to being called forth, so that we learn to be able to be with our difficult situations. We learn to be with our own limitations. That we learn to acknowledge fear and still move with the fear and not be frozen by the fear, to find some sort of self-acceptance, this kind of calling forth, because these developmental calling forth are then utilized in this inner spiritual journey of calling forth. And then as adults, we're called forth to make our way in the world. Circumstances call us forth, but also many people, the parents who are supporting us, if we were fortunate enough to be supported in some way by parents, enough already. Make your own way, it is time. Although that seems to be moving back further and further in life, much to my amazement, I have to say. And so we are called forth psychologically to cease being defined by early conditioning in our habits of mind without discrimination. That's called an individuation, where we start to have our own way of understanding, our own way of seeing. We're called forth to have our own voice. It's so important that we, at some point in time, find our own voice and called forth to make our own choices. And again, these worldly choices, these worldly challenges that call us forth by from one individual to another, as we're interacting with them, they are preparing us for the fullness of the inner journey. And we're called forth by the love relationships that we have, including romantic love relationships. We're called forth to step up, to actually respond to another. All of this is so useful, this calling forth. They can all be seen as a wholesome exchange of the heart. And from my view, not everybody would agree with this, and it's certainly to my wonderment, I have seen in my own life, and having a number of difficult situations with difficult people, that in their own way, those difficult people were also a calling forth of the heart. That in many instances, that what that person had to teach was what one did not want to be. That one wanted to be other than that. And that wanting to be other than that was the calling forth. That was the gift. That was the teaching that that person had to offer us. Such a shift in view when we understand that. Then everything has a beneficial aspect. Not denying the pain, suffering, the negativity, the suppressing even of this calling forth. But yet there is some thread of goodness to be found. Not in a Pollyannish way, but in an actual experience when we show up and we deal with those people who are most difficult and who created the most difficult circumstances for us. So this exchange of the heart, of being called forth in all those around us. And then as we are older and more able to individuate and choose for ourselves, whatever age that starts to come about, we then start feeling called forth in a very different way to take responsibility for our own words and actions. To take responsibility not by judging ourselves or comparing ourselves to others, except for the purposes of discernment of what's skillful and unskillful that we have done, that we know how to do, that we might do in the future, and what's wholesome and unwholesome in terms of how we would choose. And once we start to have this kind of knowledge, which others are giving us in these various ways, then we understand that the way to redeem the past, the way to redeem the past is not by changing the past, which is a fool's errand. It's delusion, this idea that we can change the past by making the conditions of the past other than they were, but by having our actions and our words and our feelings and our very thoughts, our very aspirations, be in response to the past in such a way that the past is redeemed because it takes on a new meaning. The past takes on a new meaning by our understanding, our realizations, our aspirations of the heart. And so this calling forth to choose non-suffering over suffering occurs through all of our interactions. And if we're most fortunate, some that are quite healthy in that exchange. And then as this comes about, we start to find ourselves choosing to be in Sangha, to be among people who are like-minded in terms of this inner development of seeking a larger meaning than acquirement in the world of satisfying all the ego needs, or even just having a healthy ego, but something beyond even a healthy ego. And that is this mysterious inner journey that the Buddha offers in the Eightfold Path, in the Four Noble Truths as a whole. And as part of that being called forth, we're being called forth to surrender so many different things in our lives. We're called forth to serve, to be generous. We're called forth to be ethical, to have renunciation. We're called this wise intention, Sammasamkappa of the Eightfold Path, kindness, the intention of kindness, the intention of non-harming, and the intention of renunciation. These three, this is a calling forth that is occurring. And so we become available to the Dhamma. We're called to be available to the Dhamma, to show up and let the Dhamma do us. It's said that if we stay present in the context of the Dhamma, that the moment is self-liberating, that the Dhamma will do us. So we're called forth to see for ourselves. Ei pasiko, the Buddha says, come see for yourself. Is this true or not true? Will this apply to you or not apply to you? This calling forth, not to say this is the way it's supposed to be, but rather come see for yourself how it is and how you can relate, how can all of us choose non-suffering over suffering. Such a wholesome exchange, this calling forth. We're so fortunate when it takes place in some sort of a formalized way, a ritualized way, an archetypal way that is more in line with our whole tribal heritage as human beings, the human tribe, where the symbols are used, where ritual is used well, where there is care and nourishment and encouragement. But in whatever form it takes, maybe not the most propitious of circumstances, whatever our circumstances when we're called forth, that's what we have to work with. And I would suggest far better to appreciate the being called forth than judging or feeling sorry for ourselves over the particular ways that we have been called forth at various times. So take just a moment here and think of yourself as a child. And name one person who in a positive way or a kind of neutral way or not so skillful way called something forth in you. Just take a moment to think about that and appreciate that person. Thank you. And now think of a time as an adult that someone called you forth in relation to your capacities to manifest, to be. Think of someone like that. It could be anyone from a friend, to a spouse, to a teacher. I'm not talking yet about your own inner journey quite yet, but your capacity to make your way in the world, to be safe, secure, to feed yourself, to make your way, to hold your own, to develop a certain skill. Think of one person. You may already think of many, and it's fine to hold many as well, but hold them individually. Smile at them. Smile at that person. And silently thank them. Feel the gratitude of those who have helped you on the way. feeling this gratitude as part of this wholesome exchange. And so often, we forget it. And now, finally, think of someone, some teacher. It could, again, it could be a teacher in person or a teacher on tape or in a book, a living or dead teacher, or a fellow traveler on the inner journey. It could be a poet. Someone who has aided you in your own inner journey. Someone who's really, you could honestly say, if we had time to do this tonight, which, and when I do this as a day long, this teaching, we take time to do this, that you would name that person. And you'd be able to say, I'm really grateful for that person and what that person did in terms of calling me forth. Again, I'm wanting you to feel it in your heart. Smile at that person and thank them. You know, it's very challenging sometimes to answer a calling. It's very difficult. In part, it's difficult because we feel a calling forth, but we're in very challenging circumstances. It's our past conditions and our habits of mind are such that we can't quite show up to hear it. We sort of hear it, but we don't really hear it. And it could be in a small moment. We're just called forth in this moment, just to manifest in this moment. And yet we don't quite do it. Because we have to overcome all of the other conditions that are present right now, all of the past conditioning, and any kind of habit of mind that we've developed in relation to those conditions. So it can be very hard to just in a very small way to step up when called forth. So lots of compassion for ourselves. Lots of compassion, tenderness, this friendness, this metta. So karuna and metta. When we're called forth and we can't quite do it. And likewise, we so often have such a mistaken perception about ourselves and what's important to us. Just an honest misperception. I call it in emotional chaos to the clarity, the myth of fingerprints. It's so easy to have a misperception and think that, oh, this calling isn't for me, or I can't do this, or I'm not worthy of this. They don't really mean me. The Buddha didn't really mean me. However we hear it. And it's not so written out like that, like in Times Square, one of those signs going around Times Square. It's this really quick little flash. It's so easy to miss. And also, we have to deal with all of our past defeats. And sometimes when there's this sense of being called forth, which might be have happened to you today, might be happening to you right now, because there was already something up. And our exploring this together, you go, I'm sort of being called forth by that person or that circumstance. And yet there's all those past defeats when we feel as though we didn't step up or it didn't turn out right and all. And so we can lack the faith to respond. And yet, if we don't respond to being called forth, when the heart's being called forth, what are we doing with our lives? What are we doing? I ask myself that on more than one occasion when I find myself so busy in the doing and not being in the being. What am I doing? I have felt this calling. What am I doing? Am I honoring this gift of a life? Am I honoring all of the teachings I've received? Or am I being affected by these conditions, these past circumstances, by the immediate distractions that are all around me, by my responsibilities, which is a big one for me? I'm so seduced by my sense of responsibility and cannot respond to the calling. I can choose to be more responsible than to sit and just be. To sit in the stillness and watch things move. Does that make me more effective, that I'm always being responsible, or less effective and responsible? It's a question for each of us. And then there's also this lack of imagination, where we may feel the calling forth, and we kind of go, oh, I want to do that, but we can't quite imagine how to do it. There comes, in my experience, around a calling forth, a moment of which I term the imaginative possible, where, in fact, we go, I might be able to do this. I'll give you an example. I had tremendous body pain when I sat for the first 10 years or so. No exaggeration there. I may be being modest with 10 years of my practice. But somewhere in, I don't know what year in, but some years in, I thought, after having sat for an hour, maybe I don't have to get up. And I didn't. That moment that I thought that was a moment that I termed the imaginative possible, where my story, my view, my perception was altered in such a way that something suddenly seemed possible, although I did not know if I could do it. I did not know if I could, but I might be able to. I call that the imaginative possible. And when that moment of imaginative possible occurs for us in relation to any calling forth, there's a new level of faith. It's faith in the possibility. And that much faith I have witnessed now in many, many yogis on retreat and working with in the local Sangha and day-longs at Spirit Rock. That moment of imaginative possible brings forth a new kind of faith that allows more to happen. When we're being called forth in a healthy way, or when we're calling people forth in a healthy way, we are holding that imaginative possible for them. We are carrying the gold for another. When we know, when we see, if I'm doing my responsibility well in this role, which is just a role I'm playing, I'm a practitioner, I'm not a teacher. I'm a practitioner. But when I'm in this role, playing this, acting out this set of responsibilities, I and anyone sitting in this chair is carrying the gold for each of you. The more skillful we are in carrying the gold for you, the more likely you are to be able to have to respond, to have that imaginative possible moment of like, yeah, maybe I'll go on retreat. Maybe I cannot be so harsh in my inner speech to myself. Maybe I can meet the rudeness with kindness. All levels, these small little things, to immense beyond measurement, stepping forth. So this is the beauty, the magic, I don't really like to use that word magic, the beauty, the power of this kind of exchange that can happen. Then as we step forth, as we respond to the call, there arises this need in the heart to be witnessed. And again, there's this mutual kind of exchange, because we both need to witness, and at some point our own heart calls us to place great importance on witnessing for another. And here is this beautiful, 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 beautiful exchange. It's so wholesome. It feels so good. You know what it's like to be witnessed. Some friend, maybe. A teacher. A sibling. Even a child. Not a small child necessarily, but an older grown-up child that can witness you. How wonderful it is when you feel witnessed. When you're telling a story, or that you've just it's some action, and someone has witnessed that action, and you know they've witnessed that action. You can feel it. You can feel that they are witnessing, that they're there in that action. They're seeing it. They're feeling it in you. It is empowering in so many ways in terms of our going forward. And when I talk about our needing to be witnessed, in my experience in the Dharma, is that it's a fullness of being witnessed. Yes, we need to be witnessed in our sincere and honest effort, but also we need to be witnessed in our inadequacy, in our ineptness, and our shallowness. We're not really wanting those to be hidden. We want them to be witnessed, ideally witnessed in a way that we then aren't judged. We're not in any way excluded. No part of us is excluded. Because we always, as I said in the meditation, we have to start where we are. Where else would we start from? If I ask you to get up from that side of the room, to don't get off the Zabutan except from over there, how could you possibly do that? Or you over here to get out of that chair from those chairs, how could you possibly do that? And yet so often in our spiritual practice, we want to start as though we were sitting in a different Zabutan or in a different chair. It's not possible. And so we have to start where we are. And therefore, to have permission to feel worthy to start where we are comes from being witnessed. From being witnessed. This witnessing in our inadequacy, in our ineptness, our shallowness, we start right there. This teaching of starting over has this implicit, but again, in Emotional Chaos to Clarity, I name it so specifically because I have seen time and again that when I am skillful in this role of witnessing, it is so empowering for another. So yes, we want to be witnessed for how hard we're working, but we also need to be witnessed in terms of how lazy we are and indulgent we are. We start where we are. Yes, we want to be seen in our enthusiasm, in our convictions, in our confidence, and in our faith. But we also need to be seen in our doubt, our uncertainty. It's the combination, it's the wholeness. It's being seen in the opposites that the Buddha taught. The same opposites that C.G. Jung talks about, that is the second half of life, effort, the task of the second half of life to reconcile these opposites. How can we begin if we can't own the opposites? Until we can witness for ourselves in a way of non-judging, non-comparing, non-fixing, we need to be witnessed by another. Again, this is carrying the gold. That someone is carrying our gold. And when we are witnessing, we are carrying the gold for another. It's so satisfying to get to carry the gold for another. But it's so difficult to do without first someone having carried our gold, someone having witnessed for us. There's a felt sense, just like in the meditation, I kept pointing to the felt sense, to the direct experience, the direct knowing. This is how we are able to become a good witness, is by being witnessed. And so, as we do this, there comes an acceptance in ourselves that allows us to move that which is most difficult in us. We are reminded of our heart's capacity. We are reassured as the worthiness to make this journey. We're consoled in the losses that we've encountered along our way by this witnessing. We are stimulated in our efforts and in our creativity because someone has witnessed us. We have a feeling of relatedness of having been seen. We are celebrated just as we are. In my early practice, I didn't easily find teachers that suited me. The first two teachers that I found that suited me were Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. And I just the pleasure of being with them in the, either a group or an individual interview, because I felt this celebration, this sense of being seen in this way. And I saw the importance of finding a teacher that works for us. Not a teacher that's like you're with every moment and all this. We have all these false ideas about how much attention we need from a teacher. We, in my view, don't need that much attention, actually, because pretty much all of our problems are everyone else's problems, and so we don't really need that much individual attention. We can take the general advice and do just fine with it. But confirmed, feeling confirmed in the sincerity of our heart, how important that is. Isn't it not easy to doubt the sincerity of our own heart? Is it not easy to lose that? And to feel received. Because when we're received by another's witnessing, it's as though the Dharma as a whole is receiving us. Such a deeply satisfying experience. The Buddha, and time and again in the suttas, is witnessing one person and another. I don't know if you know the story of when the woman at the well fell in love with Ananda. This woman was Ananda, who in all his purity, you know, of all this practice, he was drawing water from the well and taking it back, you know, to the Sangha. And this woman that was a maiden that was there, it's told in the sutta, sees this countenance and sees, this is a good man. This is the man for me. And follows him back in pursuit. And the Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, this woman. And the Buddha says, bring her to me. And he listens, he witnesses her deep passion, her that this she has found in another something that is worthy of love. And the Buddha very patiently witnesses this. And then he says, this feeling you have is your own feeling in you. This is this capacity of love in you. You don't need it in another. It is there in you. You can find it in yourself. And then on the other extreme, with Angulimala and having been a taker of lives, his witnessing the Angulimala's anger and despair and staying present for that. Forgetting the name of this queen that was such a devout follower. Anybody remember the name of the queen? Can't think of it right this moment. Witnessing her and she would come talk to him she was always teaching her husband, the king, and the king was very much looked up to his wife as knowing more and being a way to point someone who could point the way for him. And again, the Buddha was so patient, and all that she came to share, but also the consort who invited him to lunch. As she came and studied with him, and as she said, would you come to where I dwell and have lunch? And here come all of these rich merchants in the town, and they come for teachings, and they say, we'd like you to come to our house to dine. And he says, I have a previous engagement. I've committed to having lunch with the consort. He was witnessing her innate goodness, not seeing her as her profession, not judging her by some particular of social actions, but as her innate capacity. This is this deep witnessing. Oftentimes, we will seek out witnessing for reasons that are in the shadow. I don't have time to go into many of these, but it is because we're just simply wanting attention or to be flattered or to feel particularly important. There's many reasons for this. This can show up on a retreat. It can show up with our friends at lunch, where we're seeking attention that's not wholesome. When we recognize that in ourselves, not to judge ourselves, but to see, oh, that's not skillful. This isn't wholesome motivation. And just stopping. No story about it. Just stopping. The wholesome exchange of the hearts that come about by our sharing is the third of these exchanges. The Buddha, as I recounted in the story that's told to us, he left the continuity of bliss for the difficulty of walking all over northern India, as it was constituted geographically at that time, to share, to give, to offer, make his offerings. There was within him, within the Buddha's nature, therefore within Buddha nature by a tautology, I suppose, this impulse, this intuition, this calling, this instinct to share. And he did so. And he did so with a patience and not a demand. He didn't go only to those who agreed with him. Once Ananda said, you know, Venerable Sir, we must leave this village. They don't like us here. They don't understand us. They ascribe bad motives to us. And we need to leave. We need to go to this other village because they are eager for us to come. He said, oh no, Ananda, we must stay here till they can see, till they can understand. So there was not a cherry picking of this offering. The offering was everywhere, available to all. Many other things to be said about that. Our motivation in our own sharing is partially to help. Partially it's out of gratitude for what we've received. Partially it's because, is there anything else that is of more useful, more valuable with our time? Do we really have something better to do with our time once we've met our basic needs other than to offer whatever it is we have to offer, again, in the way of service? And it could be a school teacher, as a Dharma teacher, as a nurse, whatever way we're helping, whatever way we're making our offering to whatever we have to offer. We can be motivated by the delight in what we've known, that in the offering of it, we are in that delight. It can be a sense of responsibility. It can be a sense of connection to others that motivates us. And we can also have mixed motives, and not to be afraid of the mixed motives. So we can, for instance, we could have had an experience and we want to share that experience with others because each time we share it, we get to feel alive in it again. It's fresh in us again. That's mixed. It's something good we're offering, but that we're trying to serve ourselves in it. It's mixed motive. Not to be afraid of mixed motives, but to emphasize that part that's wholesome. Emphasize that part that's wholesome. And again, of course, we can get very shadowy in our motives sometime. We won't do that tonight, but it's there. And then what's being shared can be, again, very modest or very large. It can be for a few. It can be for one. It can be for many. It can be for the young, the old, the in-between, for all. Sometimes it's information we're sharing. Sometimes it's knowledge. Sometimes it's technique. Sometimes it's practices. Sometimes insight, wisdom, values, all of these different things that we're sharing. Sometimes it's just our presence. Sometimes it's our enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm for practice may lead someone to come here and practice. Your appreciation, your expressing appreciation for what you've received may motivate someone else in a way that all of the urging of others have not done. But it's you, what you are experiencing, the way your heart is, that touches another's heart. We do not know what will touch another's heart. We don't know when another's heart will be touched, and we don't know what is it that will touch that heart. And so as we're sharing by our very being, by our living what we have gained, we are being available for this wholesome exchange. It's very modest, this exchange. Modest sitting here, modest in our daily lives. It's always modest. It's always filled with not knowing. But it's being true to what we do know, what we have experienced. And so in this way, we make this wholesome exchange of sharing, we make this wholesome exchange of witnessing, and we make this wholesome exchange of being called forth. Thinking that we need to be on one side or the other of that is maybe not so useful. But being available in the days, hours, minutes of our lives to participate in these three wholesome exchanges, however they arise. This is the offering of reflections for this evening in this way. And in that context, anything that you would like to ask or say about these three wholesome exchanges, and then I want to take a few minutes back to the meditation. So anybody have any question or anything you would want to say about this? Then I have a question or two for you. The first question, are you really open to living at this level? Are you willing to say, I am worthy, and I'm willing to spend the time to choose the vulnerability to be available for these wholesome exchanges as they arise? Not in my nice little structured way, now I'm going to have a wholesome exchange with my child. Oh, now, you know, my friends ask me for help, so I'm going to have a wholesome exchange. But to be much more unstructured, to be rawly available for this exchange of the heart. And if not, why not? What is it you're believing that would prevent you from being more available? I was preparing for this talk and was sitting in a public space and had a wonderful interaction with this woman we were the only two people in this public space. And when I first sat down, I said, am I going to be less bothersome to you if I sit behind you or in front of you? And she laughed over that. And she said, you know, I don't really care. And I said, well, then I'll sit behind. And so I sat there. And then she was still there when I was leaving, and she was working on something, I was working on something. And as I left, I said, you know, I really enjoyed our conversation. And she said, oh, I did too. And she said, also, I got a lot more work done. And she meant it. That was an exchange of the heart. We both felt seen as human beings. We both felt respected as human beings. Two sentences, three sentences, really, maybe. So, that's the first set of questions about this. The second set of questions, is there some place in your life that you're not seeking a witness where you need to be seeking a witness? And if so, what are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? Yes, I know you have this story about how you have tried to find a witness, but what are you going to do about it? Maybe it's a stranger sitting in an open space. And then the third question in this regard is, when you think about witnessing, when you think about being the one who calls someone forth, when you think about sharing, what feels wholesome about it and what feels unwholesome? Where's the charge? Where's the charge that gets in the way? And where's that actual heart space that doesn't have that charge, that doesn't have that extra oomph from the ego? Where's that in you? Could you start to cultivate just the heart space that wants to participate in this way of being the one calling forth, being the witness, Could you cultivate that heart space and let the other just be? Not judging yourself, not useful, not comparing yourself to how you should be or how someone else is, but just finding that heart space in you where you're willing to carry the gold, where it would be an honor for you to carry someone's gold, but an honor where you are more and more bowing, not more puffed up, but more and more. Just such an honor to carry the gold without preference, without discrimination, but to carry the gold of another in whatever encounter it might be. Taking just one of these questions could be the next year's life work. And now, just quickly before we end, any question or comment about the meditation of working with the stillness of earth and the movement of wind? Anything you want to ask about that? Equating it to this experience around working with knowing versus that which is being known. Such a well-cultivated group of silence. I actually am not surprised because it's not that easy to do, but I'm gonna ask you to say some specific things if you don't. So one way or the other, we're gonna talk about this one.
Well, there's a sense for me of, I think I know and then I'm not sure because there's a kind of abstraction to the wind and to the earth, the solid and the, and when you speak more about, bring forth a witness that I personally experienced or, bring forth a time, there's a tangibleness to that and it moves my heart. And the other, I get it, it's kind of abstract. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe unpack the value of the more conceptual wind and earth doorway into the conversation.
So the question about the challenge of earth and wind being abstract concepts and not actual felt experience. The use of the words is to point to your inner experience of anything heavy in your body, and likewise of anything that, in terms of movement, anything pulsating or vibrating or like a wave motion in the body. So it's a pointing to a direct experience, to a felt experience, and we have to use language in order to find this, what I found for myself is going back to it over and over and over again, so that what was sort of like I could go, yes, that's heavy, but that was just a label, to know I'm feeling heaviness. Heaviness is like this, where I really know the feeling of heaviness. And I know the feeling of firmness. I know hardness. It's not an idea anymore. I know hardness is like this as an inner experience. One 3-month retreat, I got interested in the elements. I wandered around looking for a teacher, and I'd say, teach me about how to work with the elements. And this teacher would say, oh, go talk to that teacher, and then I'd go talk to that teacher. Everybody kept sending me around, and they'd send me back to some people I'd already been to. And I finally said, no, I'm just going to have to do this. And so I just kept working with this over and over and over again. Although some people like Pauk would be a great, I don't know, Pauk Sydal is a great person to work with the elements with. But it's just going to your own experience over and over again. And so the hardness and the firmness and all of this is one level of it. But then you notice that, oh, there is a kind of stillness. Like your body is still. We know that cup is not really totally still. But compared to if there was a fan blowing on the cup, relatively, the fan's got a lot more, that air of the air generated by the fan has got a lot more movement than the stillness of the cup. And so we start to see that we can actually know the felt sense of stillness, and we can know the felt sense of movement. We can really know, I know. Not just am I knowing stillness, I know I'm stillness. And I can access it directly as a felt sense. And then we see that in relation to knowing versus what's being known. And suddenly in Nietzsche, and this arising and passing and all, become not concepts, but actual felt experience also. That's why I wanted to offer that as a stimulation. one more question if there is. Yes, please. Yeah, sure.
When you had said that difficult people can be
they can call you forth.
Can you just give me one example of how to look at a difficult
perspective? Yes. I started to give it from my own life because I had that experience myself. But a yogi on retreat that worked with me on a number of retreats had been through all sorts of psychological work having to do with a very difficult parent who really did horrible things to him, very difficult things. And so there was this trying to get over it, to try to like, all of these different ways of trying to work with it. And so we were on a long retreat together, and he would come in for his practice discussion meetings. And I waited till the time was right, and I said, so do you do da-da? And I named all the things that this parent had done to this person. And then the yogi said, no, I don't do that. I don't do that. It was very strong. I said, well, have you ever done it? No, I was so clear I wasn't going to do this. And I said, so that is the gift of that parent to you. Look at the clarity of your mind. Look at the in total commitment to never doing that. Look at how you are absolutely developed the opposite in you. That was the gift of that. That was the gift of this parent to you. That's what this parent called forth in you. Many, many tears in this man. Many, many tears. And for the first time, and this was not a young man at this point, the first time that he could report a sense of relief, a kind of changing, a not demanding that the past be otherwise, not seeking justice, not wanting to know why. There was like a reorientation. That is how the past was redeemed. And that's so sometimes all that someone has to give us is via the negative. Via the negative. That's all that person has to give. If we don't open to that, if we insist on how it should be, if we're holding to some sense of want it to be otherwise, of justice in all of this, then we miss the gift that was there. We miss what was called forth. And many times, we don't actually take the gift of that. We, in fact, duplicate. I can think of working with this woman one time, very early on, who talked about having all these memories of her mother beating her, hitting her, like her mother would set her up in order to be able to punish her. And then she started crying, and she said, what's horrible is I see myself wanting to do that with my child. And just huge tear, was not doing that, but could see in the strongness, and had not taken that experience and confirmed something in herself, that what had been called forth by her, but had not completed that process. And that was my work with her, was to call forth in her, to be what called forth for her to find this, to see, no, you are not this. You're not this. What you learned from this, what was called forth in you was nonviolence to your child. That's what's called forth in you, and helping her move out of that just imprinting to a deeper understanding. Do you see what I mean by that? So these are two examples around this. This is not an easy subject, but I have reached a point in my life when I'm not interested in just sort of saying the easy. I wish to empower every person in this room in relation to whatever it is we're exploring. And tonight what we're exploring is these wholesome exchanges. The wholesome exchanges are not mamby-pamby. They're not peaches and cream lots of times. There's a lot of feeling of fear around them. There's a lot of vulnerability. This whole weekend when we're going to be exploring the role of the heart in practice, it's not like sentimentality. That's not the role of the heart. So I speak so directly in this way, and I hope that no one finds it too difficult or too disturbing. But if we're going to really have our heart available to practice heart's queer courage. It takes courage. It's willing to be with the difficult in the heart space, not just abstractly or not as a theoretical practice. We're at the end of our time here, and I'm going to ask you we're going to do a little, just 30-second closing, but first we have to address the question of rides and transportation. You found someone, okay. Anyone else? I love the sharing of the rides. We get to do Sangha. We get to actual practice Sangha. So we're done? So close your eyes for a moment if you're comfortable having your eyes closed. And I'd like to do the metta practice that I do with the Sangha that I'm directly associated with in Marin County. And the phrases are a little longer, and we're going to be saying them out loud. I will say a phrase out loud and ask you to repeat it out loud. When you're repeating it, you're offering it to every other member of the Sangha. And then the very brief ensuing silence, you're receiving the metta from everybody in the Sangha. Note that it may be hard for you to stay present, but also notice if you stay present in the silence, it feels really good to receive metta. So, the wholesome exchange of the heart in this. May you be safe from internal and external harm. May you be safe
from internal and external harm.
May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. May you have
a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart.
May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital. May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life, just as it is. May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life, just as it is. As we become aware of the three wholesome exchanges of the heart, may we step in the path of the Buddha and engage fully in these three wholesome exchanges in such a way that everyone with whom we come in contact is benefited, that we're available to each and all in these exchanges of the heart. May our practice this evening, all the merit of the practice this evening, in some ways, directly or indirectly, be of benefit to all beings and their exchange of the heart on the way to the end of suffering. Again, thank you so much for having me here, and hooray for this beautiful home. Hooray, hooray, hooray. Much, much mudita to all the Sangha.